Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collected works of Jane Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I'm Annie, a.k.a.
And I'm Jessie.
And today we are talking about our favorite adaptations of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, including the 1995 BBC miniseries and the 2005 movie directed by Joe Wright. But before we begin, we have to introduce our extra special guest, our good friend and fellow Us Nightlist.
Woo! Hello.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I am so excited and so honored that you guys are allowing me to join. I love it. And I'm, thank you, just so excited.
No, we are so happy to have you. We've pretty much been talking about you coming on since the inception of this podcast. So,
which is right. And you're our first guest.
You are. Ooh, it's so great. Exciting.
Unless we count our cats like purring in the background.
The cats are permanent hosts. So.
Oh yeah. Man, pressure's on. I got to really perform now.
You got to live up to a lot there with the cats.
I do.
That's true. But yeah, Liz, why don't you tell us a little about yourself and sort of why you love Jane Austen, how you got into it, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I'm Liz. I live in California. I will say my introduction to Jane Austen was something that my mom and my aunts and my tias were like growing up. They're like, you'll love it. You'll love it. And I was like, no, I'm not reading an old book. I love the Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley instead.
Yeah. fair.
Right. Yeah. And then as I got older, I'm trying to think of the first one I saw. I think I actually did see the Gwyneth Paltrow version of Emma, which is also when my mom was like, you should read the books. And I was like, nah, not doing that. And then Clueless was like my favorite. But then Introduction to Pride and Prejudice, I saw the 2005 version first. And since then, I've read the books. I've been following along with you guys. And just kind of preparing for this, I realized that I've actually read or seen almost every, as that I can think of, adaptation of Pride and Prejudice possible, including the Hallmark versions of the variations.
No.
Oh, yeah. Pride, Prejudice, and Mistletoe. That's a good one. So yeah, there also used to be, so Jane Austen's birthday is in December, right? December 19th or something like that. And the library here in town where I live would do an annual Jane Austen tea. And it was right around my mom's birthday. And my mom likes to make sure that her birthday is at least a 3, if not 7-day celebration, as she should.
Of course, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So we, it would be an annual thing that we'd go to. It's a tea lunch, and it had a silent auction before where you could bid on like first editions or like illustrated editions of all her works, and then like clothing and just different things that were related to Jane Austen. And people would dress up, and then there'd be a tea and there'd be a reading. Every year had a different theme. And then there'd be like just kind of Jane Austen in general theme. We went for like 6 years in a row, I think. And then there would be dancing at the end, which was super fun.
That's incredible.
I want to go to this.
I will. I have a few photos that I found, so I'll have to send them to you guys so you can see. One year there was a big step and repeat of Pemberley that you could take photos of. And then they did like a cutout version of Jane Austen. You could take photos with her. Actually, that's how I got into, we'll talk about it later, but Eligible, one of the versions of P&P that exist. I bought it there to support the library. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's so awesome.
So yeah, that's how I got into Austen. And it's great. I love her. She's so influential, much more than she gets credit for.
Oh my God, she's flipping everywhere. And I love that it was just this thing of the women in your family passing it down to you, almost a little forcefully, but...
My best friend has loved the 1995 version. And I texted her when I was watching. I was like, guess what I'm finally watching? And she was like, how have we gone this long? We've been friends for over 20 years at this point. And she's like, how have you gone this long? And I was like, that's spite. And she's like, well, it sounds about you.
Yeah. So,
but yeah, she's also been a part of it. So there's, she used to come to the tea with us. And she's also, yeah, again, like you said, the women in my life have always been like sheltering me to it. You will love this. Trust us.
I love that so much. It's ours.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, normally we start off these episodes, as you know, talking about the other things that we're reading or watching at the time, anything that's just basically taking our attention. So, as we always do, let's start with Jessie.
Yes, well, I recently finished a book called Spoiler Alert by Olivia Dade, and it was a delight. It was a romance, of course. I feel like all I talk about is romances now. It's about a geologist named April, and she's a fan of this Game of Thrones-esque show called God of the Gates, and she ends up on a date with her celebrity crush, who is one of the actors from the show. And his name is Marcus Castor-Rupp, which is basically Nikolai Coster-Waldau. And she writes fan fiction. She basically feels like she's a double life because she has this like huge online fan and friend community. And then she has her real life. When she starts dating this actor, her real life and her online life sort of begin to converge. This book really has no business being as good as it is. It's really well written. It's a super hot romance. The leads have really great chemistry. And they give like snippets of fanfics that each of them have written, as well as ridiculous scripts that he's said no to. And it's really meta commentary on Game of Thrones. Like they talk about like fridging and all these concepts that if you're a fan of the show and maybe disappointed in the way the last season went, they go in deep. It's really a love letter to fan communities and online friends. They're just as real as those friends that you know in real life. And so it's really appropriate that I'm talking about it on a podcast with people that I met online.
One, that speaks to everything that I love too. We did all meet because we were fans of Game of Thrones, so that's even more appropriate.
Oh, it's really good. I think the showrunners of like this fake Game of Thrones show are like Ron and RJ. And like the big climax happens at like a convention.
Oh my god.
Like a fan convention.
Did Olivia Dade show up to Con of Thrones? Did we meet her and not know that she was there?
Oh gosh, I really hope so. I mean, she talk about like Archive of Our Own. They go in very deep. You will appreciate it. I think you should read this book.
Ooh.
Also, it's a plus size heroine in this book, which I really feel like I don't read a lot of those in like romance novels either.
Yeah.
All right. Because what I didn't have is enough books on my to read list that you've been contributing to for these many years.
Yeah. Well, you too, Annie.
I got you to read Interior Chinatown. That's all I needed to accomplish for
you.
It was
so good. It was so good. Okay. So I'm done. I'm done talking about books. Annie, what are you reading?
Oh, I only have like so much mental capacity for attention. Since I've been trying to just watch as many of the adaptations we've been talking about for this episode, I haven't given myself much time for reading. So I am still in the middle of Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, which I'm loving, and switching back and forth between the text and the audiobooks. And the same story goes with You Had Me at Ola by Alexis Daria, which I admit took me a second to get into, even though it was like cute and charming at first. But now I'm learning a lot about sensitivity or intimacy training or coordinators on sets and stuff. And there's a lot more Spanish in it than I really expected. Not like a ton, but enough where I just have to stop and stare at it or listen to it for a second. But it's getting good. So I'm enjoying both of them immensely and horribly disappointed by the recent adaptation of Rebecca. I don't want to talk about it, guys. It's still a very sensitive subject.
So bad.
So wrong on so many levels. I don't want to talk about it. We don't have time.
I know nothing about the story and just the reaction that both of you and the Slack had about Rebecca makes me want to watch it without any context and then see what my reaction is to it.
Please do and report back.
Okay.
I would love that.
I also feel like I need to make it a drinking game as well. Maybe recap and like see what the things you all hated were and then see, just take a shot at those points or something like that. I don't know.
Well, it was nice knowing you. You'll be dead.
I made it to the pod. That's all that matters.
Yes, we finally got you on. You've achieved all you need to. What have you been reading, Liz?
Well, I've been on pause a little bit preparing for this, just kind of going back and rereading bits of Pride and Prejudice and Pride and Prejudice and Other Flavors, which I think we'll talk about later. But one of the books I started was If You Leave Me by Crystal Hannah Kim. And I have a tendency, like you both, to purchase a lot of books and then not actually get to them. So I've made it a goal to finish everything that is on my Kindle before I purchase something else, which is very wow. difficult. Yeah. Does not apply to Audible because those credits come whenever. So I have to use them. They're just sitting there. But it's about the Korean War. And it's told from three different viewpoints, two boys and a girl. And I am not going to even attempt to pronounce their names because I'm going to butcher them. One thing that I really appreciate about the book is that there is a lot of Korean tradition in there that I can shamefully admit that I know very little about. And it's really sad, actually, I will say, starting off, because they're all teenagers and it talks about how their lives have just been torn apart, upended. And I think it'll go more into it, but there's a little bit of classism in there. It's post-World War II, but the initial occupation or war between that the US invades and Russia and China also reminds me that we know we are taught literally nothing about the Korean War. And so it's required me to Wikipedia and Google a lot of things as well, which I don't mind, but it's taking me a little longer to get through because of that. So I'm curious to see where it goes because it kind of follows their lives and they're interwoven. It's a little bit of a love triangle, but the girl doesn't seem interested really in either of them. So I think that's what makes it a little more interesting. Mm-hmm. She's just trying to get through life. Then I'm also, I read and then I do an audiobook at the same time, usually when I'm washing dishes. So I'm listening to The Hating Game by Whitney D. Grinenson. And I just started, I'm only a few chapters in, but it's really cute. It's two teenagers again. And one of them comes to live with the family of the girl and they're very wealthy. And he wasn't like necessarily poor, but he didn't come from a lot. And so there's a little bit of tension there to start off. And she's like, you're upending my life. She's 17 years old. She's very popular, very beautiful. So everything in her life is about her. We'll see how it goes. If there's a little bit of, there's definitely some tension right off the bat. So it's cute so far.
Nice. It's so funny. I feel like I've read another book called The Hating Game. Isn't there like a romance?
I think there is because that's what I assumed it was going to be.
Yeah, me too. So it was like a fun surprise. Like, oh, it's a different version.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I thought this was the one that everyone was talking about in the Slack. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. Like I said, I'm only a few chapters in. I actually started the audio version of Pride and Prejudice. There's two different versions, but there's a Rosamund Pike version. That's the one I have.
Big fans of her.
Oh, I've heard beautiful things. Yeah.
Speaking of Rosamund Pike, she was in the 2005 Joe Wright version as the lovely and practically perfect in every way Jane Bennett. I like this movie a lot, guys. I don't know about you.
You know, it's weird because I love so much about it, but every time I watch it, I like it like a little less for some reason, and I don't know why. So I'm hoping I can like unpack that here today.
Yeah, I like it for a lot of reasons that aren't related to the material that it's based off of.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good way of putting it.
It's beautiful. There's so many great scenery shots. I feel like there's a lot more comedy in it. Mm-hmm. But the material is like...
I think this is probably like our for most people, their first experience with Joe Wright as a director. This was actually probably my first adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that I'm aware of. So, and having now been able to say I read the book, there's definitely a lot missing there from the book. A lot of it's abridged, a lot of it's condensed, and I can see why some people don't like the things that are not in the movie. But it is a beautiful film, and I think it's actually really masterful in how it manages to convey a lot of the things that don't need to be said explicitly.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. I love the performances. I think Keira Knightley is probably one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Elizabeth Bennett's. She's just such a good... You can see why she got nominated for Best Actress Academy Award for this performance. I forgot how good it was, I think, especially at the end. She really got me. For some reason, though, I didn't feel the chemistry as much between her and Matthew McFadden as I remembered feeling or seeing. I don't know.
Do you think it's the actual actors or do you think is it just the material and not having as much time to spend with the two of them?
I think maybe it's how they're playing it, or at least how I feel like Matthew McFadden, that's his name, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. he plays Darcy a little more socially awkward instead of proud. So his scenes come off a little bit more like you feel bad for him rather than the sort of like haughty change, like the change Darcy that I like. And that we talked so much in the book about how Darcy really grows as a character and as a person and becomes sort of worthy of Elizabeth and vice versa. And I think Elizabeth goes through that journey in the movie, whereas Darcy's just sort of socially awkward and then becomes more comfortable around her.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, I like Matthew McFadden as Darcy, but I think that's just because he's so handsome.
This might also be his best hair.
It's great hair.
I actually wrote down one of my notes as wet eyelashes in the scene where he's like proposing to her and professing everything. His wet eyelashes make him really just sad puppy that I love. Yeah, I don't know what that really means, but that's all I could think of. But I agree. I think, yeah, he's more socially awkward. He's much more earnest and like almost desperate for her attention, where Colin Firth is, like you said, much more proudful and much more proud. And yeah, you don't see the change as much. He's still very handsome.
The cast in general is pretty great.
Oh, it's so good.
Very good looking. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was laughing that Tallulah Riley plays Mary and she's like a supermodel.
She's pretty gorgeous.
Yes, it's like, really?
Costume makeup gets a lot of credit for that one.
I know. And then she just has like these kind of downturned puppy eyes where she just very easily looks like miserable and pitiable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Carrie Mulligan as Kitty is, I think that was her debut, right? Wasn't it her?
It was definitely one of her first.
Oh, the first time I saw her was in Education.
Oh, yeah.
And she was spectacular in that. So to go back and see her as Kitty, it's like she's like silly and giggling. It's such a 180.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we have, who's that? Jenna Malone.
Isn't she American? Or
she is American.
She's American.
Yeah. Jenna Malone of Saved fame.
Hunger Games.
Donnie Darko. Pulling off a fairly decent English accent, I think, and doing a very good job with the character of Lydia.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like when she picks up the wine and, like, drinks it, and Lizzie, like, switches the wine for the water, and she, like, switches it back in such, like, a small scene.
The little mannerisms that Lydia took on in this one, I think, really... I really like her role and what she did with it and how she handled it, but I'm also like, God, you are insufferable.
So much so.
So insufferable.
I think that does make it... I mean, and this is something we had a problem with the book, too, where we're like, why is... Wickham into this, because it's really hard to understand in the movie, because I think in the adaptation, in the 95 miniseries, I was remembering how much more time Lydia had just pulling on Wickham's arm and pulling him for dances, mm-hmm. and all that stuff and trying to flirt with him. But in the movie, you're like, oh, this is a left turn I didn't see coming.
Right.
You know, it's funny. I just recently for the pod watched Death Comes to Pemberley, which I actually liked way more than I thought I would. And I really mm-hmm. didn't like the book. Death Comes to Pemberley, it's like a sequel type mystery courtroom
Murder
drama.
Mystery. Yeah.
was written after the fact. And they did a miniseries of it. And we'll probably talk about it later. But they do a lot of flashbacks in it. And so one of the flashbacks is to Darcy discovering Wickham and Lydia. In the conversation that they have in this flashback, they make it very explicit what happens. And it's basically Darcy trying to implore Wickham to marry Lydia because otherwise she'll be ruined. And Wickham slides him a piece of paper very creepily, and Darcy opens it and says, well, this much. And so I think that really made the subtext text of Wickham's basically blackmailing or extorting Darcy in order to pay... him money in order for him to marry Lydia. And I don't know if that's exactly how it went down, because we get like the story told three down the line from what happened, and we know that Darcy gave a lot of money to make it all happen, but it never really clicked for me that maybe that's how it went down, that it was just so much more mercenary, that he was just, this is how much money it'll take me to marry Lydia.
Do you think that Wickham used his bargaining chip because of he knew that Darcy was in love with Lizzie, or because Wickham just like hates Darcy?
That's a really good question.
Extorting Darcy wasn't something that occurred to us when we were reading the book. But mm-hmm. I think we did talk about how, like, did Wickham know that Darcy and Elizabeth were having eyes for each other? Because he's a fairly perceptive guy when it comes to like relationships and how to play people. So I think that's totally possible.
That's a really good question. Because I think in their last conversation, in one of their conversations, he still tries to play like the victim, mm-hmm. and he's still complaining about Georgiana and complaining about Darcy. And Lizzie's like, yeah, well, he's a nice guy and you suck. And Georgiana's like adorable. So it is sort of after the fact, because at this point he's visiting Longbourn as Lydia's husband. So I'm not sure, but... It's bad all around. He's like a bad guy.
Yeah. No, he's terrible. He's garbage.
He does seem more like petulant and not quite as savvy in the Joe Wright version.
Yeah. What are your opinions about, what's the actor's name?
Rupert Friend.
Yeah.
I liked at the time, but every time I was like, I feel very lacking and I don't understand why you're that into him. Mm-hmm. And why is he super into ribbons?
Well, he has his own ponytail. It's like a slick back ponytail.
As we know, Rupert Friend is a great actor. He's done wonderful stuff on like Homeland. And
him and Keira Knightley were dating for a while too.
Yeah. Didn't they meet then and date? I feel like that contributed to the chemistry between them.
I think
yeah,
so.
I felt the chemistry more between them than Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadden, which I guess makes sense if they were really like together.
I don't remember the actor who played Wickham in the 95 version, but I feel like he was much more petulant and much more that, like, that version feels like he's like, well, you're just gonna give me money because I know you're a well that won't dry up for me, and I'll find something. Like, just keep paying me to keep me away from Georgiana. Where the 2005 version, it does feel like he's more astute to the relationship between, or the infatuation between him and Lizzie. I don't know if that was intended or not.
How much of this is it us projecting onto these different
I know,
versions?
right?
Yeah.
Well, whatever. It's our podcast. We get to say what we want.
Yeah.
I don't think he gives off nearly as much of a predatory vibe in Joe Wright's version.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's good or not, though. What do you guys think?
He should sort of give off a predatory vibe, at least when it comes to Lydia and maybe Miss King a little bit.
There's not very much King stuff in Joe
It's
Wright's
like 5 seconds
there's
of
not.
it.
Yeah.
Barely even mentioned at some point.
Yeah, they do a good job streamlining it. You're at, like you said in your summary, Annie.
Yeah, some of it isn't actually important stuff. I know some people get quite attached to those moments, feel that they're super important, and that's not to say that they aren't. But like you said, Liz, separate on its own, I still think that it's a pretty good movie, you know, in its own little package, separate from everything.
Oh,
I
yeah.
really like the casting. I think the casting of Mr. and Mrs. Bennet is very good. Like, I really like Donald Sutherland. But I will say that at least towards the end, it sort of bothered me what they did with the parents. Like, it seemed very different dynamic than the one we see in the books. Mrs. Bennet is still, you know, obviously trying to get her daughters married, but they give her a little bit more well-roundedness. There's that moment where Wickham and Lydia are leaving Longbourn as a married couple, and Lizzie's watching them go, and her mother comes up to her and sort of gives her this, you know, sad, you know, like it's always so hard when your daughter leaves. And then they have like this hug moment, which is not, I mean, it's nice that they like have a mother and daughter moment. And then later, after Bingley proposes to Jane, Mr. and Mrs. Bennet are in their bedchamber together, and they're having this very lovey-dovey moment where they're just talking about how rich and fancy Jane is going to be. And when I read it in the book, it seemed a lot more like annoying versus this like loving, tender scene between Mr. and Mrs. Bennet.
But is that because Donald Sutherland just plays like a doting father so well?
Yeah, there's less of a
Yeah.
bite to him in
Yeah.
this movie.
Especially at the end. And Brenda Blethyn is also just gives off warm, big hug mom vibe in general. So it's really hard for me to see Mrs. Bennet by that actress that way. And even though he is kind of dismissive and colder at the beginning, Donald Sutherland with his big dad hug personality as well, it's just sweet the way they pulled it off.
I feel like, I think you guys mentioned it a few episodes ago, where Mr. Bennet is not that great of a father or a husband. And I think that it comes off very much more accurately in the 95 version, but whether it's Donald Sutherland or whether it was the direction and the screenplay that was given to him, it almost feels like Donald Sutherland's, he's a little more dismissive in the beginning, but it almost feels like that's what he feels like his role is. Like, he gets to be the dismissive kind of funny one because it's a big joke to him, but he really does love his wife and his daughters. And it comes out in the end where in other versions, it's kind of like, are you an asshole or do you care about this? Are you just being mean to everyone?
Yeah, there's a line of dialogue he reads at the end when Lizzie tells her father that Darcy paid for everything for Lydia, and he says, I must pay him back. And he says that in the book, but he says it as a joke. He's like, I'll tell him I'll pay him, and then I won't because, you know, he'll tell me that, like, oh no, it's my love. Like, I did it for my love. Like, it's a very wry joke, and it's played
Right.
as a joke. Versus in this version, when he's like, I must pay him back. He's like, no. Mr. Bennet would never really
Mr.
offer to pay Darcy back.
Bennett's more excited about saving some money.
Yeah, so it definitely seems to me that Donald Sutherland probably never read the book and read his script and saw himself as like the doting father and sort of just like funny guy, which is fine. It was just not, in terms of an adaptation choice, it's not my Mr. Bennet.
No, and it would have been fun to see it. I just don't know if 2 hours would have allowed enough time for that because he has his own little arc too, sort of. It's like a pseudo arc.
That's very fair.
And because at the beginning of the BBC miniseries, there's actually a moment, you know, very early on where Elizabeth and Jane are talking about, you know, wanting to marry for love. And Lizzie even points out they have a very daily reminder of what happens when that isn't present. So at least there they call it out. They point out this is not a happy relationship, and kind of draws a connection between why they're so insistent on not having that, which I think is pretty self-aware. Lydia obviously doesn't have the self-awareness, but Lydia lacks a lot of things. Can I say, though, I hate picking favorites, but this is one of my favorite Bingleys, too. I love Simon Woods as Bingley.
He's such a doofus.
He's so tall and handsome, but like hilarious. And his face is just pure sunshine and openness.
Yeah.
He's a golden retriever.
He says something like, oh, I haven't read the book yet. And Jane's like, well, you know, like because you're busy doing other things. And he's like, yes, I'm busy doing other things.
Yeah, he's very sweet. Just a cinnamon roll. Just a perfect on-screen representation of a cinnamon roll.
I love him dearly. Fun fact, in drama school, Simon Woods dated, one, Rebecca Hall, whose father created the Royal Shakespeare Company, two, Rosamund Pike, and three, he is now currently married to the former creative director of Burberry, Christopher Bailey, and I think is now apparently a critically beloved playwright now.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
That's awesome.
He's like, acting's fine, but it wasn't for me. I was like, cool. Good for you.
You've done well for yourself, sir. You've done well for yourself.
If I was married to the former creative director of Burberry, I would just be doing what the fuck ever I wanted to.
And wearing like fabulous trench coats all the time. I do like Rosamund Pike as Jane. I think she's, I mean, what we have of Jane is that she's very nice and beautiful. And Rosamund Pike is probably the most gorgeous Jane. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I remember so vividly finding out that she was cast in Gone Girl. And being like, what? Jane is so nice. How could they cast? And she did she obviously did a fantastic job in Gone Girl. I couldn't believe it that she was being cast to play this like manipulative evil character.
I had the same thought. I remember that. I was like, Jane Bennett. Okay, well, this will be interesting. But yeah, she was great in both of them. But she's also my favorite Jane. Yeah. She's so ethereal. Like just
yes. And it's not in a way that's like cold or empty or like one dimensional. There's just this person who's just holding everything in because that's just who she is. She's lovely. And her and Elizabeth cross all the adaptations, but I really loved it in this one where they're just like braiding hair and talking underneath the bed covers. The sisterly love is so sweet.
The under the bed sheet or under the bed covers and everything, I just think is so great. I did not grow up with sisters. I grew up with brothers. So I did not have that experience. Yeah. But I loved it. I love watching it because it's something I'm like, oh, okay, that's what sisterhood is really about. Okay. It's such a foreign conflict. Like, I wasn't in a sorority. I do have lots of girlfriends, not a weirdo, but it's something that, I don't know. People talk about sister relationships and to see it on screen like that makes more sense to someone who didn't have sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the best one.
Because you can imagine them doing this when they were like 9 and 10 years old.
Yeah. It's their thing. It's their thing
so
to do.
Sweet. Yeah. I think I've said this so many times now. I know there are people who don't really like that version very much. It means so much to me because it came out around that time when I was really starting to develop an interest in movies, and you've got this like interesting, complicated character and story and all like the fun parts of a romantic comedy where people are like, that makes no sense. Why would that happen? And then it's beautiful cinematography, beautiful music, kind of like helped shape how I saw movies. Mm-hmm. So I'm very protective of it. At the same time, I understand why people who saw the 1995 version and why that's just like holy grail to them. What are your guys' feelings about that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my issues with the movie was that maybe they were trying a little too hard to be different from the miniseries and people's affections for it. So they did some changes, like when Lizzie visits Pemberley, instead of seeing a portrait of Darcy, she sees a marble sculpture of him. I don't know why that had to be a difference. So sometimes things like that sort of annoyed me because it seemed deliberate in order to differentiate itself from the miniseries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think that everything he said. Also, I think this was Joe Wright's directorial debut, so I kind of feel like he was like go big or go home, especially with some of the with some of the setup shots and things like that. They're beautiful, and it clearly is his style, as we've seen later on in his movies.
Meditating on the edge of a cliff while the wind blows you back.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's sweeping. Mm-hmm. A little weird, kind of like what. What are you doing there? There's literally no one around, but okay. But I did like the miniseries, of course, seeing it for the first time just recently. I like that it does follow the book closer, and it does allow for a lot of things to breathe. And I think you get some of the better, you get more talking in rooms, which is always great, but you also get the relationships to develop a little bit more, and some of the things make more sense. Well, especially the relationships between all the Bennets and themselves, and even the gardeners, and just even why society, the way that it operates, is so, why some of these things are so important then, especially like the propriety that Lizzie and Jane get so embarrassed about the lack of from their family, because you see it so much more in the setting of everything else.
In general, I tend to prefer miniseries to movies as much as I love movies, at least for book adaptations. So having the room to breathe, plus there are so many iconic moments in the book, it's so nice to be able to see them. And some of them still make me cringe, like seeing Colin Firth say, you know, "Any savage can dance." Oh, still kind of gross. So I like the dichotomy of it. I like getting, you know, hitting those beats that, you know, you absolutely have to have, the certain lines that were so memorable in the book, and to have someone actually say them. I didn't see the miniseries till much longer after the fact. So it's so great. Probably not quite as much affection, but like objectively, I love it. I do think in many ways, you know, it is the better adaptation. I do remember, though, more than once Keira Knightley talking about when she was cast or trying to get cast for the movie, Jo Wright immediately rejected her at first, saying that she was too beautiful for the part. And she's just like, that's a really nice reason to not get a part. But she was able to get into meet with him anyways. And he's like, oh, no, you're fine. It's like, excuse me, Jennifer Ely is gorgeous.
But it is funny because everyone's always like, well, Elizabeth, because there's a line in the book that it's in most all the adaptions where it's like, oh, yeah, Jane is so much prettier than Elizabeth. I mean, Elizabeth is pretty, but Jane is so much prettier. And it's funny because Keira Knightley is like one of the most beautiful women in the world. So you like have to find Rosamund Pike to like play her sister.
Basically. And it's not even to say that the other sisters are in any way anything to scoff at. Carrie Mulligan, Tallulah Riley, and Jenna Malone. Come on.
Right. Yeah. I think we'll talk a little bit about Charlotte and her relationship with Lizzie, but I think the miniseries, the way they handle that relationship between the two of them is so different. And I like them both for different reasons. Kind of going back to my point where like the 95 version really gets the viewer to understand why marriage to a young, rich, handsome man was so necessary for so many women, especially with Charlotte in particular, where she marries Mr. Collins, and it's kind of, she's, in the book and even in the adaptation, she's much more calculated about it. And I think that it is a better representation of what women and how they interacted at that time probably was. Someone who's clearly not a time traveler. Mm-hmm. But I like how that version handles it better. I think that the 2005 makes Charlotte much more pathetic and desperate, where the 95 version validates her reasons a little bit better. Better in the sense that it's tied to the societal pressures, where actually I take it back, they both are, they just handle it so differently. Yeah. Charlotte has less guilt in the 95 version, which I think is a product of the society, where Charlotte in the 2005 version has more guilt because she values the friendship more versus her place in society.
Yeah, she sort of, I have that line in my head, like, I'm already a burden to my parents.
Right.
That's not in the book and not in the miniseries. And so it's her sort of like pleading to Elizabeth versus just saying, no, this is what I have to do. Deal with it, Lizzie.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it's not something we talked about when we were going through it with the book, but just listening to you two, it's so interesting that Jane Austen is, you know, basically satirizing romance at the time and has her main characters really fighting for marrying for love instead of for convenience or for monetary reasons, that she does go through great lengths to be like, Charlotte, we love Charlotte, Charlotte's smart, marrying for money, which we're kind of frowning upon. But at the same time, she has the heroine of the story being like, I was super wrong and you were right, which gets downplayed in the book, in both, at least in the Jo Wright version. And not as much in the miniseries.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it goes to how each of them portray Charlotte too, right? Where like Lizzie is, you know, she's more, it's more natural and it makes more sense for her to say, like, I was wrong and you were right to Charlotte in the 95 version because of Charlotte, how Charlotte handles her engagement to Mr. Collins, where saying that to someone who's like, I'm already a burden to my parents, I'm frightened, I don't know what's going to happen, and then being like, oh no, you're right to be frightened, like that's not okay.
Yeah. You know? No, I really, I much prefer, I think, the way the book and the miniseries handle the Charlotte situation, because it's, the reason that it's in there is to give like a kind of a reality check to the reader. And it's Jane acknowledging, yes, I'm writing these like beautiful love stories, but the reality is probably more like Charlotte's situation. And that's, it sucks for all these reasons, but Charlotte's making a power move for herself, which, you know, it's her prerogative. Like, who are we as the reader to look down on that way of going about things?
Right. Especially if that is your option at the time. If you are, you know, if you do come from a town, a village that doesn't often see these types of men coming through, then, you know, you have to, which I do think is something that is, that says something about, you know, being a reader in 2020 versus being a reader even in, like, I can't remember what year these were published, but like the mid, you know, late 1800s.
Would you say the Regency period?
The Regency period, yes. The perception, I think, is different, right? Because it's, you know, like, my first reaction reading it was like, how dare Charlotte do that to her friend? Like, chicks before dicks, bros before hoes. You know? That kind of thing. Like, that's just, you know, I could imagine feeling so betrayed. And so I think that the Joe Wright version handles that in a way that speaks to the modern audience better, where the 95 version is like, no, this is how it was. Like, this, there is no betrayal or long feeling betrayal between the two of them, because they both understand that this is what they have to do. And I also wonder, and I have no historical background on this, but I do wonder if that's why the relationships between the sisters was so important and valued, because it's like inherent competition between you versus like making friends outside of familial relations, where that competition for a man is even stronger. And I hate that I just said that, but I think, I do wonder if that's part of it too, where Jane is kind of even acknowledging that, but addressing it in a way that readers at any era can still understand. And like you said, who are we to judge?
That makes me also think of, not to talk about a different adaptation, but the Lizzie Bennet Diaries and their portrayal of Charlotte. It's obviously a different proposal situation, because Mr. Collins is proposing a business relationship, a partnership, and not like a romantic one, but it is done very similar and in even more modern context, because it's basically sort of now, was it like 2012?
I think so.
Yeah, around that.
And the episode that you sent us to watch, Annie, had Charlotte basically being like, who are you to say what I want and what my dreams are, Lizzie? Like, we are both in debt. Like, we both have these things. Sort of check your privilege. Like, I'm going to make this decision. I hope we're still friends, but I need to look out for myself.
I love that personal take. We will get to it.
Yeah.
I appreciate the two different approaches to it. One of them just like being, this is just how people operated on a practical level, and this is how probably some women acted on an emotional level, because everyone's telling them, you're going to be useless if you're not married. Now's the time, or else you're worthless.
You're too old.
You're too old. You're 28. Yeah.
Too old.
Sorry.
As someone who's 10 years older than that number. That's what I love to hear.
Exactly. <You're too old. laughs> I appreciate the different approaches on that. But yeah, it does come down to like the miniseries had more time to develop these things, and then they can hit certain beats and show like a more organic arc. And if you can't do that in an abridged 2-hour version of a movie, I can see why it would be so hard to try to make it fit without shoehorning it in there, or just kind of like flattening that curve of the story in general so it's not as important. But as someone who loves the Charlotte part of the book, that does hurt a bit.
Yeah.
Again, though, the casting was still fairly phenomenal for the miniseries.
I saw the miniseries. Actually, it's funny. It's not the first adaptation I saw of Pride and Prejudice. My mother had me watch the 1940 version with Greer Garson and Laurence Olivier, which is very on brand for my family. Uh-huh. And I loved that. And it's a very different movie and a different story entirely. It's a lot more, it's a lot funnier and sort of slapstick. Lady Catherine in it is in on the joke. She's basically sent by Darcy in order to get information from Lizzie about whether she still likes him. It's very cute, and Laurence Olivier is very attractive.
I'm looking at pictures, I agree.
Yes, and it's a cool, I hope, I'm sure it's probably available on YouTube or something, but I recommend people check it out. But so that was my first, and that was my gateway into the book, which I read next. And then I saw the miniseries, and so I saw that before the movie. And so I'm definitely one of those, like, oh, why are they making this movie? Like, there's already a perfect adaptation out there, which is maybe not the best way of thinking. But so maybe that's why, too, I have a little bit more defensiveness maybe for the miniseries. But just the Colin Firth of it all, I think, will always really just be in my heart. There's the iconic scene of him taking the bath or in the swim.
I mean, the Colin Firth of anything is really the best thing ever. I did admittedly think the bath scene of in the new Emma with the changing clothes. I went, is this just required of all Jane Austen adaptations? Because I understand this is, you know, supposed to be the ideal man as portrayed through a female perspective written for women of the time, and I'm into it. I'm not complaining.
It's one of the instances of it being sexier with not over the top.
Yeah. Sex without sex. It's without low-key sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say I knew I kind of forgot about that scene until it was coming up, and then I laughed so hard when it played in front of me, because all I could think about was, do you remember like 5 or 10 years ago an artist did the plaster recreation of him coming out of the lake, and it just looked absolutely terrible?
I do not remember this, but I'm going to Google it right now.
I remember when that came out, and it was like, I mean, he just looked like a monster emerging from a lake, and the shirt was supposed to be wet, and it was like,
this looks like it's from like an adaptation of Frankenstein. It's bad.
And Taz, my best friend who loves this version, she was not pleased with it. And I was like, what is this? Is this really a thing that happens? Like, why is this? What is going on? And so that's all I could think about, which probably ruined that scene for me. And I had to go back and rewind it. I was like, okay, be serious now. Be serious.
And he just sent me the photo. And you have to put that up on our Instagram.
This is going on the Instagram. Because this is the worst thing that ever happened to Jane Austen.
Oh my god, why is his neck so long?
It's the nipples for me, really.
So that ruined that. Oh, and no. You're right, it is very sexy, but I had to watch it a few times to understand that.
To get this image out of your mind? Yeah, that's fair.
Well, the miniseries was adapted by Andrew Davies, who also adapted the Sense and Sensibility adaptation that we watched when we covered those books, and I really hated that adaptation. And it was because he made it so sexy. It like literally starts with the sex scene, which is ridiculous because there's no sex scenes in Austen. And same, we talked about a little bit about Sanditon, which is adapted by him, and they like made something. I mean, Jane Austen didn't finish Sanditon, but she definitely didn't write Handjob in it.
I was literally about to bring this up too. What happened to Andrew Davies? Because like he did the Les Miserables miniseries, which I loved. Just as someone who's a fan of the book, separate from the musical, he did the War and Peace miniseries. Also, no Handjobs. That wasn't that long ago, which is great. But he also did Bride to Head Revisited with Matthew Good, Ben Whishaw, and Hayley Atwell, which I really like. And he wrote both the first two Bridget Jones's movies. The first one, which is great. The second one, we do not speak of in this house. He's kind of all over this guy.
Yeah, it was really disappointing to see that Sense and Sensibility adaption just go for it. Just because I think there's a way to be sexy without like seeing explicit sex. And yeah, I mean, you know, when Colin Firth emerges from the water, not like that photo, but in the it's a very
I have to stop staring at it.
It's a very sexy scene. It is like a sexy scene, and like their banter is sexy. Like there's ways to be show chemistry without people getting naked or making out. Mm. That isn't to say I don't want there to be more kissing, because there's like only one kiss in the miniseries, and it's like really awkward. It's like the mm-hmm. end, like marriage kiss, and
it's a very weird kiss.
It's so bad.
And like the whole time, Colin Firth is giving her these eyes where you're like, oh, sizzle. So much sizzle. I can't wait to get a kiss. It's going to be so hot. And you're like, that's
it.
I know. Okay. It's such a bad kiss. But
he was also looking at the statue of himself.
Oh, my God. I'm never going to be able to get that out of my eyes.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Also slightly tainted for me now is that like the follow-up to Pride and Prejudice, Joe Wright did an adaptation of a book called Atonement by Ian McEwan. Mm-hmm. Beautiful book, beautiful mm-hmm. movie. Also starts with like a moment between the two main characters played by James McAvoy and Keira Knightley. But mm-hmm. in that opening scene where you first really meet them, Keira Knightley's character is the one who goes into the giant fountain and pulls something out and stands up in front of a male character. And that's when things like start hitting off for them too. And I was like, that's an interesting turnaround.
Yeah. I don't, Andrew Davies, I don't know.
What are you doing, Joe Wright?
What's going on? He just likes people who are soaking wet. And I don't know.
He's only human.
But I do like the chemistry is just there within their like banter back and forth. And the scenes are like longer between them than I think in the movie, because obviously the movie's mm-hmm. like truncated. And so you really get the full breadth of how compatible Lizzie and Darcy are, I think, in the miniseries, because mm-hmm. it is time to do that. So I don't begrudge the movie for obviously like giving other people lines that aren't originally theirs and speeding up the scene. But having really the time for those scenes to really develop is such a gift that the miniseries gives us.
I really did enjoy the chemistry and the dialogue and just the slow build of the relationship between Jennifer Allen and Colin Firth. I got the heart swelling, like, oh, I love this so much at the end of it. But which made it that much sweeter that it took, what, 5 episodes for that to happen?
Six episodes total.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That they drew out that tension.
Yeah, they really did. But it's so good. It's so good when it happens.
So we were actually going to pick out, like, you know, say which of our favorite of the two was. I can't do that. I honestly just can't. So I was wondering if you guys just wanted to talk about, like, what do both the adaptations get right, or talk about your favorite certain choices, like certain castings, which were your favorite between the two, or certain moments that you think one did slightly better than the other?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I don't like choosing favorites.
No, and I you know, I agree with you, especially because it's hard. I think depending on which one you saw first really makes mm-hmm. a difference. Right. So it's hard to play favorites. I feel like I'm just sort of picking and choosing my favorite adaptation. Like, I'll take a little bit of Judi Dench's Lady Catherine over here and a little bit of Keira Knightley and a little Colin Firth and like making my own sort of amalgamation.
Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Wait,
before we go into this, can we talk about Catherine de Bourgh a little bit more? Like, and how...
Always.
You guys are going to hate me for this, but she's very Trumpian.
Go on, please.
We're not going to stop you.
I couldn't get this out of my head, but when she talks about how she has just such a natural talent and for music, and that she would have been a great proficient if she had ever learned as well as sort of Anne. you see it, don't you? And she talks about how she would just so willingly take on anyone and help fund their efforts, which like she does with Mrs. Jenkins, but she wants everyone to know that she's doing this. And then she just, oh, there was something, I wish I'd written it down, but there was so many things just going back and forth between the two of them. I was like, this all sounds very familiar. This sounds so familiar with how these things are being said. And they're just, I know, I'm sorry, I ruined it. Judi Dench can never do anything wrong, and she still doesn't. But it's just, man, did he get read this when he was a child?
No one read a book to him. No one has ever read a book to him as a child in a loving way.
She's very bloated in her opinion of herself and how she could give out opinions to things. I mean, even the conversation with Lizzie where she's asking questions, but then she doesn't actually want answers to them mm-hmm. or any sort of pushback.
And she's just trying to eat her soup. Yeah. Just let me eat my soup.
Yeah.
That is one thing that is like fairly consistently correct, I think, in like every adaptation I've seen, where she's always very like, oh, everyone says that I'm super helpful and comforting and calming and say the right things in all situations. Like, I don't say that, obviously, but people say that. And you're like, oh, no. Oh, yeah, no.
I think that really is just like a really wider point about how money kind of can really corrupt you, about how just having so much of it and just surrounding yourself with people that you're paying basically to be nice to you and who don't like check you or challenge you in any way. Because Lady Catherine doesn't have anybody being like, no, like, stop it. And Darcy himself says that to Lizzie. He says, you know, I was really prideful and that was like a big sin that I had. And even my parents, like, they spoiled me and no one ever said no to me until I met you. And you kind of showed me what it was like to want someone who's worthy of being wanted. And I think that's really important for his growth as a character. And we really talked about this ad nauseum, so I don't need to go on. But I think that's a really good overarching point about how Lady Catherine's really on the other side of that spectrum, where no one ever told her no. She never surrounded herself with people that would challenge her and help her grow. And so she gets to just sit around and be like, oh, I would have been a really good piano player, because no one's going to say anything different.
Oh my goodness. Versus like Darcy is like, wow, that was really hot.
That was really hot how you told my aunt that she should mind her own business.
Yes, exactly.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And that's why the weaker personality, like Catherine de Bourgh, eventually was just like, I'm sorry, I'll be nice now so I can come hang out with you at your big house.
Yeah.
Keira Knightley and Jennifer Ely, it's really hard to just say anything bad about either of them as Elizabeth, pitch perfect.
Yeah, can you imagine being like young Keira Knightley, like a new like baby actress, like having to have that scene with Judy Dench's Lady Catherine, God, where they're like yelling at each other? I think that was when I was like, wow, Keira Knightley's a really good actress, because she's going toe to toe with Judy Dench, and I would be like crying.
For as delightful and delicious as Judy Dench seems as a person, I recently listened to an interview she did with her daughter, and I just wanted to hug her. But in that scene, she is coming for Elizabeth, and with the lighting especially, she's so terrifying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so good. I know, I think we'll talk a little bit more about it later, but the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Oh, God.
We can talk about it now.
So I have a little fun anecdote about it. So as much as I've talked about, you know, I love Jane Austen, my mom loves Jane Austen, my aunts, my tias, all of that. My dad, I think like many men, has made it through 60 plus years of his life not watching any of it, reading it, anything. And one morning a few years ago, it was early, he gets up very early to watch soccer, and he decided to watch Pride and Prejudice and Zombies because it was on and Lily James was in it. And that is the only version of any Jane Austen. I don't even think he's seen Clueless that he's ever seen. And it is the one that he's like, it's so good, he'll tell anyone about it. He's like, have you seen Pride and Prejudice and Zombies?
Oh, no.
Because it's not basically anything like Jane Austen at all. It's just a very loose, you know, he likes the zombie part a lot. But Lena Headey as Catherine, Lady Catherine de Bourgh, that with the, there's a good lighting scene to talk about the lighting with Judy Dench. That I feel like that version also was inspired by the 2005 of like, she's behind a fire and she has an eye patch and it's like dark. But
there's only I forgot half she had an eye patch.
Yeah, she has an eye patch for some reason. I can't remember why.
That's good. Probably casting, a zombie. Lena Headey.
Lena Headey is so good.
Perfect and everything. She's like a harder version of Keira Knightley.
Yeah. She really is. She sunk into that role for her like 5 minutes in it or something like that. Leans into the intimidation factor that she may have picked up from some other series. I'm not sure where.
All right, what other things do you think both adaptations do write?
I mean, Pemberley's pretty beautiful. They really nail. I love the in both versions when Elizabeth shows up with the gardeners at Pemberley and like looks at it and just like laughs. Yeah. Like, it's like such good scenes because they're just like, this, I could have been the mistress of this house.
Sure.
Yeah, that's one of those moments where if it was now, you'd be like, shut up.
Are you kidding me?
I do appreciate that in both versions, you get a lot of laughter and amusement from Elizabeth because she is just like going through like me like, oh, God, people.
So anything else we want to talk about with the miniseries? I mean, we could talk about it forever, but no one wants to hear us talk about it forever.
Both Mr. Collins also were super wonderfully on point.
Mm-hmm. He was both like perfectly horrible.
Yeah.
And in a low-key kind of way too, where you're like, I guess I can't I mean, I can super tell you why I don't like him, but at the same time, it's not egregiously obvious, I guess.
Yeah, you can't make it too bad because you don't want to, like, rescue Charlotte. You have to, like, sort of understand.
He's much more like Weasley in the 95 version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that he's, I mean, he just seems, and I can't remember the actor's name, but he's a very good actor in the 2005.
Yeah.
He's more pitiful. Mm-hmm. And so you almost feel like, okay, well, you're just very awkward and weird, and that's okay. But the other one is like Weasley, kind of creepy and gross.
He's more like willfully ignorant of how terrible he is.
Right.
The second one. Not that I don't love Tom Hollander in everything he does. No, I've recently restarted watching Rome, and the actor from the 95 version is, oh, I forget his character's name there too, but he plays like a Roman senator, and it's very political, and he's so astute, and it's slightly strange to see.
Interesting. I can't believe it's Tom Hollander. Oh man.
Tom Hollander disappears. It's really
funny. He really does.
I was just saying, the first thing I can remember distinctly seeing him in is About Time.
Oh,
I know. I love that movie.
So good. It's not great, actually, but if you don't think about it too hard, it's so good.
Yeah. Just take it surface level.
I'm looking at his IMDb. He really does just show up places.
He's in everything. I will say, I'm pretty sure Simon Woods is like the precursor to my like Donald Gleason love. Just like tall, beautiful, open-faced, pale ginger.
I can get on board with that because I too do love me some Donald Gleason. Although that's straight from About Time, I will say.
Very open and sweet and funny and a little awkward.
Yeah.
But really earnest and sincere. I'm like, okay, this is where I can be.
And you like Mr. Collins? Is that
Simon Woods?
Two very different people.
Three different divergence, goddess.
Although in the book, isn't Mr. Collins supposed to be tall? Not that I am discriminating against our shorter statured Mr. Collinsies, but I always just thought it was really interesting that was the casting choice that both of them did.
Yeah,
of them. I feel like all the Mr. Collins, like in Pride and Prejudice, which I made you all watch, he's short too.
Not in Zombies, because that's Matt Smith, right? Matt Smith is tall and gangly. He is made of limbs.
Yeah.
That casting is so good in that movie, but the movie is just so bad. Sorry to your death.
It's okay. I'm not. I mean,
oh, God.
He says it with, you know, a smirk and a twinkle in his eye about how great it is. My dad is where I get my love of any bad action movie or anything like that. So he's well aware.
That's fine. What are some of your favorite and least favorite adaptation choices, guys?
I mean, mine is, I know you guys both know this, but Bridget Jones's Diary is just, I love that movie for so many different things, which I will say when I saw it, because I saw it in theaters, I did not know it was a Pride and Prejudice adaptation. I think my tia who took me to see it told me that after the fact. And it's by far the loosest adaptation other than some of the Hallmark movies I've seen. But I'm going to plug those. The season's coming up, guys. But I mean, it has Colin Firth as Mark Darcy. You know, he was so good they played him twice.
Three times. There's a sequel that again we do not speak of.
There's a baby one that no one saw.
Oh, is he in that one? No, he's not in that one though. In the third
He is. Really? It's him and Patrick Dempsey. Yeah.
Oh, I thought
it
was
Hugh Grant. Do they kill him off or something?
No. It's I've also seen that one.
I have seen it too. I like it, but I can't remember what happened in it.
Yeah. I like what they did with it, even though it was like very bittersweet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little hard to watch, I think, if you love Bridget and Mark together. Mm. But Patrick Dempsey's also very handsome, so it's kind of hard to.
This is true.
But I Bridget Jones's Diary, I think I was 18 when it came out, and it really made an impact. Bridget herself made an impact on me, and I absolutely love her. And I know it's fun to like the adorkable term, which is kind of awful, but she is a big mess. And rewatching it, because it basically shoves every character and bit into five people, I think they take all of the awkwardness and like the kind of embarrassing things that the sisters and her mother do and just shove them all into Bridget. Right. Yeah. So like she's the disaster. Mm-hmm. She's the one who's always like making these social faux pas. She's the one who's saying things without thinking about them, which I think is an interesting kind of take, right? Because you're narrowing everything down. There's no Jane, right? That her Jane is kind of like all of her friends. But that dinner with the smug couple, smug married couples, is essentially her dinner with Lady Catherine.
Yeah.
Where Darcy kind of also comes to her defense. Hugh Grant, that is like peak Hugh Grant attractiveness. Yes. It's really easy to see why you would fall for Wickham with his dimples and his floppy hair.
There's a really good scene in Bridget Jones that when I saw it really sort of encompassed like everything that I love about the Pride and Prejudice story. It's the scene where they're on Bridget and Hugh Grant's character. They're on holiday. And they're at the same time as Darcy with his like work associate, who's sort of Natasha, who's like Carolyn Bingley, but her surrogate basically. And they're on these boats in the middle of this like pond thing. Bridget and Hugh Grant, what's his character's name?
Daniel Cleaver.
Daniel Cleaver, yeah, sorry. I'm just like totally blanked on that. Anyway, so they're like in the boat and they're like saying limericks to each other and like laughing like hysterically.
Cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah, and Mark and Natasha are in another boat, like, doing work, which is stupid. But then you see like, Mark look over and sort of smile wistfully at how much fun they're having and laughing. And it's just such a really good scene because I think it really just shows – because when he tells Bridget that he loves her just the way she is, you sort of are just taking his word for it because you only really see him from Bridget's point of view. But this is, like, the one scene where you just see, like, how much he wants, like, that fun in his life. And it really encompasses – in Pride and Prejudice, like how much Elizabeth helps Darcy become like a better person. And I just love that scene so much. And and I've seen it a billion times. And when I was watching specifically for this podcast, when we were talking about adaptions, it really brought home that point about how Elizabeth really balances out Darcy.
The one thing I thought in my rewatch, just kind of looking at from like the lens strictly of like the comparing to all of them, it really forces a lot of social interaction between Mark and Bridget that kind of seems weird, right? Like for him and Natasha just to randomly show up at the same hotel that she and Daniel are at for one weekend is... I love that scene as well. And I think, you know, him looking at her so wistfully really shows how much, like you said, he wants that. And it proves like she's forcing that from him. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of interesting that they have all these social circles that just suddenly appear that they didn't interact really prior to their lives, where in every, you know, in the actual book and all the other adaptations, there's a reason why they are suddenly forced into these social situations. But I think I love it. And I think it's almost, I feel like it's almost as if Colin Firth took Darcy and evolved him to be kind of like, if he was still in this position, if he was still trying to win Lizzie over, how would he interact now? Because he does feel a little more open and like he's inserting himself to try and get her attention. Where in the book and even the 2005-95, it's more of like he's, I don't want to say lurking, but he's more of like a background.
Yeah. For sure. He does have a little more life in like his own world, basically, I guess. One thing I do hate about that movie, and it's not that it's not a bad scene, it's actually a very funny, objectively funny scene, but I get so much secondhand embarrassment sometimes. The scene where she's introducing the guy who's going to introduce the author.
Oh, God.
It hurts me. I'm not kidding. I have not watched that scene in like 10, maybe 13 years because it hurts me physically to watch. I skip it every single time. I will leave the room if I can't skip it. It's very painful. And I think you were talking, Liz, about how, like, you know, she's now a mess as opposed to Lizzie, who's like more the put together, super put together person. And it fit that time period so well because you had so many more, I guess, like, and I hate this phrase, the chick lit books, where basically every main character is kind of a mess and hasn't figured out her life and became more relatable. So I love that it is more representative of just where we were culturally and women admitting that like I don't have my shit together but I still deserve love.
Yeah, and I mean there is the true Lizzie Bennet like characteristics from it where she's like, okay, this is what I'm gonna do, this is how I'm gonna be, like I'm gonna go for a job in television production, which I have literally no experience.
And she does a great job. Like the interview she gives at the end, like she doesn't, like he doesn't help her do the interview, like it's a really good interview. And at the end when she goes, did you fancy him the first time? He's like, it's so cute and like lovely. And they make her capable too. It's not just a huge mess, which I really like.
And even when she turns down Daniel towards the end, like it's not because, I mean, she knows everything about him and she has this opportunity to get back with him because it's Hugh Grant, but she's like, no, I need something more for me. This is what I that's not good enough for me. And I really like that. I love that because it gives her more agency when Darcy comes back around, where she's like, no, you're actually better for me. I like this. You're a better choice. Mm-hmm. I need you.
This is what I deserve.
Yes.
So we already have this like modern adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. Is there anything you would want to see in, if they were to remake it like tomorrow, taking place like in 2000, not 2020 because 2020 sucks, but like 2019, like what else would you want to see in the like evolution of this story?
Are we doing modern versions or like still period pieces?
I guess both, but I'm maybe thinking more modern.
That's
more sex.
Yeah.
More sex.
Or like more furtive making out in a corner somewhere.
Right, because you can't have, like, I just don't think it'd be believable nowadays for someone to be like, oh, I must get engaged without ever having a kiss or, like, spending a weekend together or, like, you know, things like that. I guess Lydia and Wickham would still work, but I would like for them to get married in Vegas or Blackpool, I guess, if we're still in England, if we're still set in England.
Or still Scotland, apparently.
Right, I guess, yeah. But I feel like that whirlwind romance makes a little more sense, but I feel like that you have to add some more crazy elements to it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I've seen it a lot in books. Like, Liz, you read Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors by Sonali Dev.
Yes.
And it's a gender-swapped version that takes place basically now where Elizabeth is – or, like, a DJ Kane.
DJ yes.
He's a chef, and the Darcy character is Trisha Raj – and she's a doctor, and there's like a Wickham character who's this female, like she used to be a roommate with Darcy and like the Darcy character in college, and then she like set up her older brother who wants to be a politician in this weird sex tape thing, like she videotaped them.
Oh. And she was a minor at the time or something.
Yeah. So there's like interesting modern sort of ways to do it. And then also in the book Pride by E.B. Zobai, which all the characters are characters of color. And it's like Zuri Benitez and Darius. And I think it takes place in New York. I think there's like the Wickham stuff is more like they have compromising photos. It's just a different sort of take on what would be like a scandal now versus someone running away with a man is not great, but it's not as much of a scandal as it was.
Right. Yeah. The Pride and Prejudice and Other Flavors, I did like that. It was, I felt like it was a little harder. They'll have to do something to make it translate better on screen versus page. Because even reading it, I felt like it was a little far-fetched from like, I guess this is believable. I could see this happening. And I could see the way that they positioned it is that the media would spin it regardless of facts. And I thought that was a much more accurate representation of what things would be like today. But I think that's where I'm like, it's hard to have it translate on screen without saying that the media is fake.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it'd have to be delicate. But I guess that's more of just an example of more modern takes that I've seen for the Lydia Wickham situation and why there's a scandal, but it's more of a scandal as we're used to scandals versus what was the scandal back then.
On a like a political realm, it's hard not to see it explode into a big, huge thing just because they're on such a public level. Oddly, in Lizzie Bennet Diaries, they actually do like a sex tape scenario, but because no one really knows them, it's not as public, but obviously still on a level that would ruin Lydia's life. So I think it works better there for that.
Yeah, the political scandal too, I think, works because he was running for governor of California. So, you know, it's a big state.
That's
got a lot
big.
Of different 40 million people, nothing to sneeze at. We're a weird state. I love us, but we're weird sometimes. But I think, it talks about like, there's this type of people and these type of people and you have to worry about this and blah, blah, blah. And so, the political scene, I think, works. It's the modernization of that, I think, makes more sense. I would say, though, I think it'd be hard to show the fallout between Wickham and Darcy. I mean, Mr. Steal Your Girl is something that will always work, but I don't know if trying to steal your sister is necessarily the best thing, if that'll make sense, right? You know, I don't know if it'll translate in a modern telling.
It's a little hard.
You'd have to do something more to update it. But it's an interesting story because I think it would still this particular story, I mean, it's been adapted so many times, and I sort of want to get into maybe why this story has resonated so much more and adapted maybe than Austin Odd's other stories or other stories in general, because I really do think it works gender swapped. I think it could work with queer characters. It works in inner city New York. It could be such a universal story, and I think it could really just be adapted in so many different ways. And I can already see that happening in print.
Well, and I think the premise of like first impressions and like what you think of someone versus who their true character actually is transcends any sort of era or society or society mores or anything like that, where, I mean, that is the fundamental thing, right? If you just isolate the two characters of misunderstanding each other and their intentions, that is something that happens in dating, right? So I think that is probably, I think that's why it is one of the most adaptable stories. I think, you know, Shakespeare gets a lot of credit for like kind of rom-coms, and especially with some of his, like with Taming of the Shrew in particular. But I think Jane deserves just as much, if not more, credit, because that is a common theme in so many romantic comedies of like, you go after this one guy who you don't really know a lot about, but it's so attractive and a little bit of danger and like a little ambiguity, but then you find out from this other person who you're like, oh, you're just jealous because I'm not interested in you, and then guy B is the one that's actually better for you in the long run. There's so many movies like that, and that is Pride and Prejudice. That's not Shakespeare. That's Jane.
That's just human. I mean, yeah, including the way you sort of, when you have a certain idea of someone or prejudice of someone, you tend to like take all the information you get and pick and choose whatever best supports whatever idea you have. And you listen to what everyone's saying, and everyone's talking from their own perspective. And like Wickham thinks, I'm sure, that he's the hero of his own story. We all generally do that, but he's actually terrible. Yeah, no, that's something that's super universal still.
It's a universal truth.
Yes, it is a universal truth. And then you've got all the societal pressures of what you should be into and what should be more important. And some people are more romantic than others, and people have annoying sisters and all that stuff. These are things that I think everyone relates to one thing or another.
But who do you think are the Lydia fans? That's what I'm curious about. Who are the people like, Lydia is right in everything she does?
Annie sent us the Lizzie Bennet Diaries to watch, and she sent us like her highlights. And I texted both of you while watching. I was like, should I be liking Lydia as much as I do? Because I've never liked I've liked adaptation Lydia's, but not because they're good people, but because they're accurately portraying a character from a book that I love.
I've seen the Lizzie Bennet Diaries like 2.5 times now. It's 100 episodes. They're like 2 to 6 minutes long. They have 2 or 3, possibly 4 tertiary channels that supplement the story that you don't need to see, but they're super helpful. And Lydia has her own channel, and she's still very annoying and very extra and drinks way too much. And one of the many things that I love about that adaptation is that Lizzie is very judgmental of her younger sister, and in many ways rightfully so. Her sister is like just turned 21 during the episode. Like, they go drinking every night that week that she's 21 to celebrate. She makes a lot of dumb choices, but they also show the way that they are not, they're sisters, you know. She doesn't hold in her judgment against her sister. She doesn't hide the fact that she thinks that she's an idiot, needs to grow up and all this stuff, but they do such a good job, I think, of taking this person who's very bubbly and who could be very one-dimensional and idiotic and be like, no, actually, all the things that you say about me, I am listening because I look up to my big sisters and they actually really hurt me and I feel very alone. And that's spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen it, including you two. That is one of the that they draw the line from point A to B of the way her sisters treat her and how she ends up with Wickham, who is very good at making her feel like she's the important one.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And I think it develops a lot more sympathy for her as the character. In the end, there's, you know, the way they develop the sisterly relationship and how she gets, you know, rescued by Darcy or whatever and is, you know, comes home, and the aftermath of their relationship and how they change and learn from each other. And from that moment, I think it's like one of the best things in the whole series. There's even the moment where I had to redo the little playlist, highlights playlist I made for you guys to add an episode, because I was like, this is the one where they made me want to cry. Just thinking about it makes me want to cry. It's so good.
They kind of touch on that too in the miniseries adaptation of Death Comes to Pemberley, which I mentioned mm-hmm. before, which is based on the book by P.D. James. And I didn't really like the book very much. And the miniseries is better, I think, than the book. But there's a scene in it where Jenna Coleman plays Lydia, and I love Jenna Coleman.
She's so perfect as a Lydia, by the way.
She's so good, and she's fantastic in it. And there's
Jenna Coleman.
Yeah, and she's very annoying in this show. You know, she shows up, and she's hysterical, and she's taking over, and everyone's sort of sick of her. But there's a scene at the end when Wickham's like been sentenced to die, basically, for this murder. Spoiler alert for a book called Murder Comes to Pemberley. Lizzie has tasked herself with giving Lydia this bad news, not this other bad news about Wickham, that he's been sort of dallying with other women. And she's trying to tell Lydia what happened, and Lydia sort of breaks her frivolous character, or whatever you want to call it, the Lydia character, and gets really emotional. He's like, Lizzie, like, please don't tell me. I'd rather hear from the gossips, because I can just like brush it away, but I don't want to hear it from someone I trust. I just sort of need to keep going. Wickham and I, we just keep going. And it's a really raw emotional scene that still felt mm-hmm. in character for Lydia. Just yeah. like, I've made my bed, sort of like I need to lie in it. I need to sort of play this part and be delusional because I can't stop and think about it.
That reminds me of, did I tell you guys about the play I saw a couple years ago, Christmas at Pemberley, which is more about Mary?
No.
What?
It was very good. And I don't know if it was a local theater, so I don't know if it's something you could find anywhere else, but it was very good. Basically, Mary finds a guy, he's a tutor, I think, Georgiana's tutor or something. I don't remember why he's there, and he's very awkward also, but they fall in love. But Lydia shows up, and it's exactly like a lot of what you just said, Jesse. She shows up without Wickham. She is trying to pretend, she's pretending that everything's fine. Wickham's just detained. He's so busy. He's just off being important. At one point, Jane, because Jane's also there, so like it's four of the sisters. Poor Kitty just doesn't get any recognition ever.
In the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, she's literally a cat.
She's not in the 1940 adaptation either.
Oh my God, poor Kitty. There needs to be a book about her. But at one point, Jane and even Mary and Lizzie are sitting in a room with Lydia, and they're like, are you happy? And she's like, she doesn't say yeah. She doesn't say no, but she's kind of like, well, this is a decision I made, and there's really no other option for me, so I'm going to make the best of it that I can. And, you know, she kind of alludes that her and Wickham don't really spend a lot of time together, that he's gone a lot. And she's just, like you said, this is her bed and she made it. And I appreciated that more, because I do imagine that Lydia in 5 years or 7 years or 2 years would realize that she did make a terrible choice, that she has to make up to her sisters. And she has that is her family. It is all who she has. You know, she's technically married, but they're going to live separate lives. And that's the best she can hope for, given the decision she made. That play, if there's ever a version of it that comes to your town, so you should definitely go see it.
That sounds awesome. Even if I can just find the script, I would look at that. I love it. So, question, since we're on the Lydia train, mm-hmm. and I think it's so interesting that these more modern adaptations, even the ones like Death Comes to Pemberley, which is set in the Regency era, try to add more depth to these secondary characters that surround them and aren't so much a caricature. What about Mrs. Bennet? Do we need to give her some justice? Are we just going to let her be the slightly empathetic but mostly toxic character that we all tolerate? Should we be able to see, you know, those moments where she hates herself for how she talks to her daughters, regrets her husband in every instance?
I would appreciate that, but I say this as a daughter. I think I'm always going to find, and I love my mother very much. She's probably going to listen to this too. I mean, I love her and I respect her, and I think she's so smart, and I think she's done so many great things. But I also think that there's always going to be a tiny bit of us, a tiny bit of that mother-daughter relationship, where I'm going to think some of the things she does and she thinks are silly because we have that 30 plus year age gap. And she's going to think some things I do are not the right decision because of that age gap and because she's my mother. Mm-hmm. To even have that acknowledgement that maybe some of the things she does are a little over the top, or maybe she should take a step back, or, you know, things like that. Like, I think that'd be nice and I'd appreciate it, but I still think that dynamic is still going to be there.
Yeah, it's hard for me to disassociate my feelings about the book, where I feel like we really unpacked a lot of why Mrs. Bennet is the way she is and sort of came to the conclusion like we understand it, but it doesn't take away from the fact that at points, like, she still is overbearing and annoying, I guess, for lack of a better word. And so maybe that's why when I saw this really sort of more sympathetic version of her on in the 2005 movie, I sort of balked at it. And I don't know if it's because it's not what I want or if it's because it's not what the book shows. But I don't know. I don't know if I need, like, a standalone movie or I don't know if I need her perspective.
I would be curious of conversations she has with her sisters about all of this, right? Because, like, Mrs. Gardner is her sister and Mrs. Yeah. Phillips is her sister.
Oh, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I would be more intrigued if it was a movie or a book or a miniseries or even just a 30-minute piece just about that and how her sisters, like, their dynamic. And then also, because they don't have children either. Or Mrs. Phillips has children.
The Gardners have children too. The Gardners have children because
Jane looks after them.
Yes.
Yeah. Because at some point they're like, well, Miss Bennet's like, well, if he didn't have kids, he would have helped pay for all this anyways, so it's fine.
Right. Yeah. So I think it'd just be interesting to hear their conversations and how they handle it. Because they also have boys too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in like a little prequel miniseries or maybe like a web series, honestly, because I don't think it would deserve a whole thing. But the three sisters and when they all met up with their guys, Mrs. Bennet runs off on her whirlwind affair and immediately regrets everything. And the Gardners maybe have like a small misunderstanding, but then end up like the Darcys. And then the Phillips were just like Mary and her piano, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I know one of our friends, too, recently said that they read a book about Mary's perspective. It was like the other Bennet sister or something. I don't know necessarily if I want that, but it's cool that someone did it. I don't know if that makes sense. But there is a lot there for other people to expand upon. And there's just so many sequels like out there if you want more of the story. And it's interesting. I didn't really like the book Death Comes to Pemberley, but I still craved those moments when Darcy and Lizzie would be together. And being able to watch the miniseries, while I didn't love it, I still really enjoyed watching Darcy be a father. And he was so, like, cute with his son. And how happy he was when he found out that Lizzie was pregnant. And, like, how much they love each other still.
And they still got into disagreements.
Yeah, and they challenged each other. I really, really liked it.
And it was, they're still like stand-up people.
Mm-hmm.
Like Darcy still stands up for Wickham because they're family now, even though he really doesn't want to.
Mm-hmm. And they treated their servants well. It was just such a joy to still, I mean, I guess that's why I love fan fiction so much, because the story can continue in the way that you want it to outside of the four corners of the book.
It is fun to have that expanded, but mostly just getting more of the same of what you loved.
Would it be the JAEU?
Yeah, yes. The extended universe.
So good. Oh, actually, for the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, I did not realize this. So this may be relatively newer, but I knew that they did one or two other adaptations, or someone else did. But Gigi, Georgiana Darcy, she works for Darcy's company, and at some point they set up some other thing in another new developing town called Sanditon. I was like, this is a home that I can start watching now. They're like, this is a really cute new town.
It really is the JAEU.
It really is. So that's what I'm going to crack into next.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I just also really like the casting for Death Comes to Pemberley too. That's really it.
Yeah, the casting's very good. My husband ended up watching like the entire thing with me and was like very confused and like asking me questions because he's never seen like an adaptation before. He's like, well, wait a minute, like who's like the sister? I was like, just go with it.
Like, yeah, there's so many sisters. I could see that being confusing. You're like, wait a second, how does this work? Who's married to who? What happened?
Just let it roll over you.
Yeah, there was one time I saw like a map of like all the relationships in Pride and Prejudice and like who was engaged or who had an infatuation or who talked to. And it was a confusing map, but I mean, I already, you know, I kind of knew the relationships and everything, but it was interesting. It had like, you know, Colonel Fitzwilliam and like Lizzie had a slight infatuation. I was like, I mean, I guess sort of. Yeah.
I mean, it depends who I was. Okay, I wasn't going to get into this, but whatever. So I mean, nope, when, when, When Annie and I read the book, we definitely talked about why doesn't Lizzie just end up with Colonel Fitzwilliam?
Right.
Because he's like an eligible whatever. But I think in the book, he's like a second son. And so there's a lot of issues with that. But in Death Comes to Pemberley,
he's also older.
And sometimes he's played older. Like, I think it depends on casting, too. Yeah. Because in some adaptions, he's played by just like an older, not as attractive looking gentleman. Whereas just in others, he's younger and hot.
Blank slate.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was very handsome in the 95 one.
And he's handsome in the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, too. Fitz, right?
Yes, he is. Although, for some reason, I had remembered that Fitz is being gay, and he's not. I don't know why I remembered him that way.
But in Death Comes to Pemberley, he plays this creepy guy who's super into Georgiana, and whose like older brother died, so now he's the first son. And Darcy's like fine with him marrying Georgiana, even though Georgiana's like in love with this other guy.
James
he's
Norton.
So creepy. Yeah, and it like totally ruined my perception about Colonel Fitzwilliam, who I kind of did like. And now I just think of him as like the creepy jerk who like goes under Darcy's like nose and does all this like shenanigans and also wants Georgiana.
So Wickham 2.0. Great.
Well, not quite.
Not
I
as
will
bad.
Give him this because like he was doing underhanded shenanigans in order to keep scandal away from the Darcy family.
So he could marry Georgiana.
So he could marry Georgiana. But in the end, he also does do the right thing of like, just so you know, I'm not engaged to Georgiana. She's available for you because we've known all along that she loves you. I'm not saying that redeems him, but he's not Wickham.
Yeah, but I just now I have this like very bad taste in my mouth about Colonel Fitzwilliam.
I'm pretty sure he played a bad guy in another thing I've watched with him in, so I didn't have a good feeling about him to begin with.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh goodness. So
Jesse, I know we've talked about so many adaptations, but I know you saw Pride and Prejudice.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
And I have seen it, but I think I saw it when it came out. I'm going to assume my mom and Taz made me watch it. And I liked it. I just also don't remember anything about it other than liking it. But so tell us everything.
It is very Bollywood, for one, in that they're singing.
And there's lip sync singing, which is the thing. So Pride and Prejudice came out in 2004, and it's a modern adaptation of Pride and Prejudice and features four unmarried daughters in an Indian family. And it's like a Bollywood-style film where there's singing and dancing, which is phenomenal. And the cast is also just so good. It's so funny because now I'm listening to a podcast that watches Lost, and I'm watching Lost for the first time. And I know Naveen Andrews, not from Lost, where he plays Saeed, but from Pride and Prejudice, where he plays Balraj, who's like the Mr. Bingley character. And he's just like very hot in it. And
he does do some serious dancing.
He's just so hot.
Dancing is so good. You have to like just watch the dancing. It's So
I'm just gonna interject also say there's a scene where they're talking Balraj and is he a Mark or a William or a Will?
He's William Darcy and he's the only like
he's the only white guy.
Martin Henderson. Yeah, I think he was in Grey's Anatomy is where I saw him.
I was like, he's the Grey's Anatomy guy, right?
Yeah.
There's a scene where they're talking about like the beautiful women they met their first night at the wedding, and it's just Naveen Andrews with his shirt like unbuttoned and open, and his chest, the breeze moving it, moving the shirt, and I'm just like, I don't need anything else from this movie. We're doing great.
My favorite musical number in it is there's like the Mr. Collins-esque character who's called Mr. Coley, and he basically moved from India to America, and he lives and he's trying to get them to like come to America, and he wants to marry one of the daughters and bring her to America. And he says this line, he says, "No life without wife." And then they sing a song called "No Life Without Wife," where they're trying to like convince the Lizzie Bennet character's name is Lolita, that she would be like totally fine going to America and like marrying Mr. Coley. And it's just amazing. It's all the sisters are like singing to her. Lolita's played by Aishwarya Rai, I think
it's Aishwarya Rai.
Okay. And she's just like the most beautiful woman in the world. Like, I'm not even the judge. Like, I think she won like Miss Universe.
Yeah. I think she's been referred to that by many people with eyes.
Yeah. It's just a joy to see her on screen. Like, she's a really good actress and very beautiful and very good as the Lizzie Bennet.
I liked one thing about that particular adaptation, other than Naveen Andrews and then his sister, played by Indira Varma, being wonderfully terrible. Oh, she's so great. Also beautiful, one of the most beautiful women in the world, in my poll of one being me. I enjoyed. I didn't necessarily like it. I thought it was a really smart choice that the things that Mark says is less like social expectation kind of thing. It's him being a casually racist white dude.
Oh my god.
I know, he like wants to build like a hotel, like a fancy hotel, and she's like, mm-hmm. No.
You just want to profit off brown people. You want people to come to India but not experience India. And everyone's just like, ooh.
Okay. But he like learns from, like, there is like growth, yeah. And he decides not to build the hotel there, and like he gets more comfortable wearing, like, there's a growth like trajectory that's like really good, I think.
Mm-hmm. My only problem with the movie, and it's more of a personal thing, is that the Darcy character looks like a combination between John Ritter and that actor who reminds me of John Ritter, Dallas Roberts. And that's who I see. And John Ritter was a handsome man, very charming. I loved Three's Company. But I kept seeing that every time I see him, and I'm like, I can't do it right now.
Oh,
that's,
no.
That's fair. I find him attractive because he's like playing the Darcy character like in the movie. So it's just sort of like, yeah. Whoever plays Mr. Darcy, apparently I'm just going to like love.
He's got a little bit of Patrick Wilson to him too.
There's also a really cool they go to America for the wedding of Mr. Coley and the Charlotte character. And it's at one of William Darcy's hotels because he's like, mm-hmm. like the Hilton or whatever. And there's a really pretty montage of like him and Lolita like going on a helicopter on the beach in California. And there's like a choir singing. Yeah. And it's just very beautiful. And
it was like in Santa Monica or something.
Yeah.
And I like that they're like, we're going to have the American version of a Bollywood dance musical moment. And it's a gospel choir.
Oh, it's, yeah. And right on the beach.
And lifeguards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Like I said, I saw it and I have zero recollection of it whatsoever. Other than, as I told you both, isn't Alexis Bledel in it?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. She plays the Georgie. She's barely in it. She plays she's also the Georgie.
Minor character is the thing I remember about it.
She's Georgiana, but I think she also takes the Fitzwilliam part where she's just like, yeah, my brother was super nice guy. He helped save a friend from a bad relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, and then there's no Mrs. DeBerg. It's basically like his mom. Like mm-hmm. his mom sucks.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, everybody should check it out. It's delightful. So if you want to be delighted.
I love being delighted.
It's all delightful. Do we want to talk some favorites? Because we're kind of coming up on 2 hours.
I mean, we've already kind of.
I'm so sorry to all your listeners.
And again, I don't like picking favorites. So I'm just going to talk about everyone that I love.
I think our favorite kitty is the cat, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Sorry, Carrie Mulligan.
Sorry, Carrie Mulligan.
But Kitty has a furry belly.
Who picked Lena Headey as their favorite lady cat?
Who do you think did? Chaos over here. Okay, to be fair.
Defend yourself.
First of all, she has an eye patch.
Fair.
What? Lady Catherine has an eye patch.
What's with your ableism?
Oh my goodness. Okay, I was going to pick Judi Dench, but...
I think Judi Dench is a great choice and the obvious choice. And honestly, I really do love her in it. And she's got an amazing wig in it, which I just... whatever they did to her hair is fantastic.
I love Lena Headey. I just want to say, I love Lena Headey. And she looks fabulous with an eye patch and without an eye patch. Like,
I think Lena does pull that same terrifying vibe that Judi Dench with the correct lighting pull.
Yeah, I just need Lena Headey in more things mm-hmm. is really why I choose her. Because she needs to be in more things where she gets to have this power and play a fearful character.
I love it.
Does anyone else have any chaotic choices?
Oh, probably. All right. How about favorite Mrs. Bennett?
Aww. No, but I don't think it's a bad thing to not choose, right? Because
So I do love Brenda Blethyn. I forget the name of the actress who plays it in Bridget Jones' Diary, but I like that she has a full internal story about being mm-hmm. feeling underappreciated and goes off with another man who admittedly has a bad orange tan.
Right. He's so
and she becomes sexually adventurous. So good for you, Mrs. Bennett.
I like that answer.
Yeah, she's the Dashwood mother.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. That's it. All right, how about Mr. Bennett?
Donald Sutherland. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, he's wonderfully dry and just checked out enough at the beginning, which I love. But Also, we talked warm, big hug, dad vibe.
Yeah, I still don't think he's read the book, but that's fine.
That's what makes Donald Sutherland the best choice.
It's true, yeah.
That's also a chaotic choice.
A little bit. One of the things I always note, though, is that when Lizzie gives him a kiss on the forehead, his head is so much more larger than her.
What a weird thing to notice. I love it.
It's all I can see in that scene. It's a very sweet moment. And she leans in. I'm like, oh, Donald Sutherland. I didn't know heads could be that big. He's a wonderful performance, but wow, do I get distracted easily. All right. What about the Bingleys? What about Jane?
I'm going to go with Rosamund Pike for Jane. Yeah. But I'm going to say Naveen Andrews in Pride and Prejudice is my favorite Bingley.
Aww.
He's just so handsome.
I am also going to go with Rosamund Pike. I think based on Jesse's description, is also going to be Naveen Andrews. I mean, I've seen him in a lot. I have eyes.
He's just so good looking.
And I think, from what I remember, his hair gets to be down in most of it. So it's
and curly. And the
unbuttoned shirt.
Yeah. And it's just, you get just the hints of the chest and like the flowing locks. I'm
more
in.
Than a hint.
And so your favorite Bingley, Annie, is from the 2005 movie?
No. I mean, I love Simon Woods. But chaotic choice, Lizzie Manna Diaries.
Oh, Bingley. Oh.
Bingley.
He is so handsome. He's so handsome.
Very handsome, so square handsome. Jaw, these bright eyes. He's so sweet. Very good kisser from the looks of it.
I mean, my jaw dropped when he came on.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. Like, no offense to the Darcy in that one, but Bing is like the hottie in that one.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I love the way they wrote his character, the way he's just like, no, look, I'm like a very loyal person. I love my friends. I'm a very smart person, but I'm also smart enough to know when to who to trust to help me, because I'm just going to be nice to everyone if not. And he's a little doofy, but also just a sweet person. And I love him. He's my bang. Sorry to Naveen Andrews, who is a very close second.
I love that his name is Bingley. It's so clever.
It's so good.
They did that. Guys, yeah. Yeah. He's my man. If you haven't seen it, just watch it for like the cute moments between Jane and Bing. It's so sweet.
I did get to the point where they were stuck at Netherfield.
And yeah, me too.
And that was so cute.
Because he's going to be a doctor and he's like taking care of her.
Yeah, because she's sick. Actually,
and talking about like, oh, you're going to die in 70 to 80 years. And she's like the talking about like them dying at the end of their lives, basically. Uh-huh. He's like, no, I'll die sooner.
Yeah. Men don't live as long as women.
Because he's like, oh, no, I'm doomed too. I've caught whatever it is. And when she's like, that's terrible. And he says, I know, it's cheesy. It's a bad joke. She's like, no, I just got really sad thinking about you being dead.
I know. It's so cute. It's so genuine.
Oh, I love them. Anyway. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. The big ones, though. Favorite Wickham.
Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
That's a good choice.
Yep.
Hugh Grant.
That's it. I was still thinking, and then you said it, and I was like, yep, that's it.
Yeah. He's handsome. He is a liar. And
he's a bad choice.
Very selfish. And he is like the bad choice. He's the choice you don't take. The bad relationship.
Mm-hmm. But look
he's
at him.
He's a fuckboy.
It's probably tied for me with him and Matthew Good.
Yeah, I was thinking Matthew Good.
Yeah.
I have not seen Death to Pemberley, but just the name of Matthew Good alone makes it a hard decision.
That man, that is a man with range.
God, yeah, he's so I agree.
Attractive.
And then he in the red coat. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. He doesn't get as many like good scenes to chew on, I don't think.
No, I was looking out for like gifts for him to annoy people with, and I couldn't really get a lot of good ones. Mm-hmm. But he does like charming, handsome, Lothario, really dangerous, makes bad choices that you want to make with him kind of thing really well. Actually, no, I may put him ahead of Hugh Grant. Sorry, Hugh.
Oh, but we have range on this podcast. It's fine.
We do. I have loved Matthew Good a very long time.
Yeah. Okay. So the big one, the big two. I'm getting sweaty.
There are no bad Darcys. Let's just say that. All Darcys, all Elizabeths are all good.
I'm going with Colin Firth. I can't. No, it's him. He's my Darcy.
Best Mark or Fitzwilliam?
Oh, goodness. Liz.
Narcy or?
I'm going with Fitzwilliam. No. I'm going as the OG.
But in the plaster statue or?
In the bathtub.
With the
getting
wrench.
Hot water poured over him.
Yeah. years. Stop making me picture that horrible image, the cursed image.
I accidentally pulled up the text where I said that to you guys, and I went, no. Actually, I might be a Mark Darcy fan, because he's out there doing, like, good things in the world, like human rights.
Yeah.
And appreciating his woman having her own career that she built on her own, and wearing ugly sweaters that his mom made him.
That is cute. I know.
Okay, both very, oh God, man, I don't know.
You're the one who put this to us.
I know, but I mean, Matthew McFadden or Patton is the one I saw first. Like, you know, I saw Mark Darcy first. I take it back. But I didn't know at the time, realize at the time what I was falling in love with, which might be why he's the perfect choice. You're right.
Aww. Okay. I love his social awkwardness.
It's so sweet. It's so endearing. And he just, like, yeah, the way that he tracks her through a room and, like, is just waiting for the moment to seize to, like, talk to her is, yeah, it's so endearing. Mark Darcy.
I do love the way that in the ball scene, when Lizzie's in the ball looking for Wickham in the 2005 version, it's just, like, orchestrated. And you see her, like, looking for Wickham, and then you see Darcy in the background, like, following her and then, like, jutting away. Mm. It's, like, very cool camera work.
The dance is between the two of them is just so great too. It's so much sexual tension.
When everyone disappears and it's just them dancing.
We do love it's a so good dance flirt. One thing that I do love that against both the miniseries and the movie that they nailed was all the, like, the hand tension moments.
Well, hand porn. Hand porn.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. Okay. Elizabeth.
I don't not love them all.
I love them all. I really do think that you have to nail your Elizabeth more so, I think, than any other character.
Yeah.
I mean, do I have to go with Bridget because I'm here?
Maybe. There's no wrong answer.
Even though she does hurt my heart when she does something publicly really embarrassing.
Oh, God.
Oh,
there's
no. So many things.
Yeah.
She is so good, though. Aishwarya Rai is, of course, wonderful.
They're actually, I can't decide. They're all so wonderful in all
their
different
really
ways.
Good. I can't. Yeah. I refuse there are to no decide. Bad
Elizabeths. Yeah. I'm going to take Paige version Lizzie or Elizabeth Bennet because she gave up all of the.
Cheater.
Yeah, I know. Chaotic choice.
Whatever. We can make our own rules.
Find that loophole.
Yeah, that's basically why we had you on, just to make havoc.
Oh, it was so good having you on. Thank you so much, Liz.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. So much.
Literally welcome back anytime.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're going to regret that.
Never.
Oh, well, no. Thank you guys so much. Seriously, this is amazing. And I just, anytime I get to talk to you too, it's just such a delight and so fun.
She's sucking up to it. Yeah.
She's trying to get on the show. I would not be 100% opposed to that. But thank you for listening and thank you for being here and spending time with us.
Yes. And
yes. No, thank you.
So that kind of concludes our Pride and Prejudice coverage, I think. For now.
Probably. Sure we'll Until there's another one that comes out, which will probably be in 2 years.
Right? True. Yeah. Who knows what's in production right now?
One day there's going to be a Zoom version of this.
Stop.
No, I'm going to just prepare you now. It's going to happen. You're going to hate it, but steel yourself.
Do you know something that's in the works?
Allow me to just hide this copy of a screenplay I've been typing up.
Right. Zoom in Prejudice.
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh.
So we'll probably take a small break.
Yes.
Jesse, what are we doing next?
I think it's Mansfield Park, right? I think that's the next one. As I quickly Googled the publishing order of Jane Austen. I know.
Maybe we should say this again, but sound much more confident.
It's Mansfield Park, which will be fun because I don't remember ever reading this book.
That's probably the one I am least familiar with. Mm-hmm. So that'll be exciting.
Yeah, that'll be good.
I don't think I've ever read it or even seen any of the film versions.
I think there was one with Billy Piper in it.
Perfect. Done.
Maybe I did see a version of that. I did see the Francis O'Connor with Johnny Lee Miller.
Really? He's in that too? Because he's also in a very good Emma. Anyways.
Yes. Anyway. Okay. Let's wrap this up, team.
Yeah, we'll let everyone know how we're breaking up that next. Just start reading it now.
Yeah.
What? No Hallmark holiday versions? Sense and Sensibility and Snowman?
Oh my God.
I could be persuaded.
Annie's like, Liz, stop.
I'm like, wait, how can we have a holiday episode?
I could be persuaded.
Yeah, me too, actually.
We'll figure it out.
I will go through the versions that I know exist and then find them and send them to you guys. How about that?
That would be awesome.
Perfect.
You're welcome to join also.
Oh, excellent.
Perfect.
It can be your mom's library Austin time.
Oh my God. You guys, those were so fun, and like they don't exist anymore. They also got a little pricey toward the end, and they're just repeating everything. But like, the dancing was so fun, and they talked about like why it was necessary at the time period, and this is how a lot of matches came, and like you were able to gossip and talk to each other, and this is how you met so many different people, and yeah, because you're literally dancing with strangers half the time.
I love it.
That's yeah, awesome. It was so fun.
Okay, so watch this spot.
Yeah, we'll let everyone know.
Yeah.
Jesse, where can people talk to us about their favorite adaptations? Tell us where we're wrong. Tell us where we're right. All the things that we didn't mention but should be watching.
Yes, we have a website, thedailynightly.com. We have a Twitter at nightlypod and Instagram at thedailynightly, which is just a riot. Annie picks the best memes. And we're definitely going to post that picture.
I can't wait. You are welcome, gentle listeners.
But please email us at thedailynightly@gmail.com. And remember, nightly spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-L-E-Y.
All right. And until next time, guys, happy reading.
Happy reading and watching.
Bye. Thank you.